Hachette Audio presents King and Maxwell, written by David Baldacci, read by Ron McClarty and Orla Cassidy. To the cast and crew of the King and Maxwell TV series, thanks for bringing my characters so vividly to life. Chapter 1. 4,800 pounds. That was roughly how much the cargo in the crate weighed. It was offloaded from the tractor trailer by forklift and placed in the back of the smaller box truck. The rear door was closed and secured with two different locks, one a key, the other a combo. Each lock was rated to be tamper-proof. The reality was, given time, any lock could be beaten and any door broken through. The man climbed into the driver's seat of the truck, closed the door, locked it, started the engine, revved the motor, cranked the AC, and adjusted his seat. He had a long way to drive and not much time to get there. And it was hot as hell. Maybe hotter. Waves of visible heat shimmered, distorting the landscape. He didn't focus on that, because he might just start puking. He would have preferred an armed escort, perhaps an Abrams tank for good measure. But that was not in the budget or the mission plan. The ground was rocky, and in the distance, mountainous. The roads had more potholes than asphalt. He had guns and plenty of ammo, but he was only one man with only one trigger finger. He no longer wore the uniform. He had taken it off for the last time about an hour ago. He fingered his new clothes. They were worn and not overly clean. He pulled out his map and spread it out on the front seat as the tractor trailer pulled away. He was now alone in the middle of nowhere, in a country that was still largely entrenched in the 9th century. As he stared out the windshield at the imposing terrain, he briefly thought about how he had ended up here. Back then it had seemed brave, even heroic. Right now, he felt like the world's biggest idiot for accepting a mission that held such a low chance of survival. The reality was he was here. He was alone. He had a job to do, and he had better get to it. And if he died, well, his mortal worries were over, and he would have at least one person to mourn him. In addition to the map, he had GPS. However, it was spotty out here, as though the satellites above didn't know there was actually a country down here that required folks getting from point A to point B. Hence the old-fashioned paper version on the front seat. He put the truck in drive and thought about what was in the crate. It was more than 2 tons of very special cargo. Without it, he was certainly a dead man. Even with it, he might be a dead man. But his odds were far better by having it. As he passed over the rough road, he calculated he had 20 hours hard driving ahead of him. There were no highways here. The pace would be plodding and bumpy, and there might even be folks shooting at him. There also would be people waiting for him at the end. The cargo would be transferred, and he would be transferred along with it. Communications had been made, promises given, alliances formed. Now it was just up to him to talk a good game and the others to keep their word. That had all sounded good in the endless meetings with people in shirts and ties and with their smartphones jangling nonstop. Out here alone, with nothing around him except the bleakest landscape one could imagine, it all sounded delusional. But he was still a soldier, so he soldiered on. He worked his way toward the mountains in the distance. He carried not one piece of personal information on him, yet he did have papers that should allow him safe passage through the area. Should, not would. If he was stopped, he would have to talk his way out of it if the papers were deemed insufficient. If they asked to see what was in the truck, he had to refuse. If they insisted, He had a little metal box with a black matte finish. It had a switch on the side and one red button on top. When he engaged the switch and pushed down the button, everything would still be okay. If his finger came off the button while the device was still engaged, he and everything else within 20 square meters would disappear. He drove for 12 straight hours and saw not a single living person. He glimpsed a camel and a donkey wandering around. He saw a dead snake. He observed a rotted human body, its carcass being reduced to bone by vultures. He was surprised there was only one dead body. Normally, there would have been a lot more. This country had seen its share of slaughter. Every so often, another country tried to invade it. They quickly won the war and then lost everything else and went home with their tanks tucked between their legs. During the dozen hours, he saw the sun set and then rise again. He was heading east, so he was driving right into it. He lowered the visor on the truck and kept going. He played CD after CD of rock music, blasting the truck cab. He listened to Meatloaf's Paradise by the dashboard light 20 times in a row, as loud as his ears could stand. He smiled every time the baseball announcer's voice came on. It was a little bit of home out here. Despite Meatloaf screaming at him, his eyelids still drooped, and he kept jolting back awake after his truck had strayed across the road. Luckily, there was no other traffic. There weren't many people who would want to live around here. Foreboding would be one way to describe it. Insanely dangerous would be another, more accurate one. 13 hours into the trip, he grew so tired that he decided to pull off the road to take a quick nap. He had made good progress and had a little time to spare. But as he was about to stop, he looked down the road and saw what was coming. His weariness vanished. His nap would have to wait. The open bed truck was speeding directly at him. The truck was driving squarely in the center of the road, blocking passage in either direction. Two men sat in front. Three stood in the bed, all holding subguns. They were the welcome wagon, Afghan style. He pulled partially off the road, rolled down the window, let the heat waves push in, and waited. He turned off the CD player, and Meatloaf's baritone vanished. These men would not appreciate the rocker's prodigious pipes or lustful lyrics. The smaller truck stopped beside his. While two of the turbaned men with subguns pointed their weapons at him, the man in the truck's passenger seat climbed out and walked to the cab door of the other vehicle. He also wore a turban. The bands of sweat soaked into the material spoke of the prolonged intensity of the heat. The driver looked at the man as he approached. He reached for the sheaf of papers on the front seat. They sat next to his fully loaded Glock, with one round already in the chamber. He hoped he didn't have to use it, because a pistol against a subgun would only have one outcome, his death. "Papers?" the man said in Pashto. He handed them through. They were appropriately signed and distinctively sealed by each of the tribal chieftains who control these stretches of land. He was counting on it that they would be honored. He was encouraged by the fact that in this part of the world, not abiding by a chieftain's orders often resulted in the death of those who disobeyed. And death here was nearly always brutal and almost never immediate. They liked for you to feel yourself die, as they said around here. The turbaned man was drenched in sweat, his eyes red and his clothes as dirty as his face. He read through the papers, blinking rapidly, when he saw the august signatories. He looked up at the driver and appraised him keenly. Then he handed back the papers. The man's gaze went to the back of the truck, his look a curious one. The driver's hand closed around the small black box, and he pressed the switch on the side, engaging it. The man spoke again in Pashto. The driver shook his head and said that opening the truck was not possible. It was locked, and he did not have a key or the combo required. The man pointed to his gun and said that that was his key. The driver's finger pressed down on the red button. If they shot him, his finger would release, and this idiot switch feature would detonate the explosives and kill them all. He said in Pashto, the tribal leaders were clear. The cargo could not be revealed until its final destination. Very clear, he added for emphasis. If you have a problem, you need to take it up with them. The man considered this and slid his hand down to his holstered sidearm. The driver tried to keep his breathing normal and his limbs from twitching, but being seconds from getting blown into oblivion did certain physiological things to the body that he could not control. 5 tense seconds passed, during which it was not clear if the turbine would stand down or not. The man finally withdrew, climbed back into the truck, and said something to the driver. Moments later, the truck sped off, kicking up a cloud of dust behind its rear wheels. The driver disengaged the detonator and waited until they were nearly out of sight before putting the truck back in gear. He drove off slowly at first, and then punched the gas. His weariness was gone. He didn't need the music anymore. He lowered the AC because he suddenly felt rather cold. He followed his directions, keeping to the exact route. It did not pay to stray out here. He scanned the horizon for any other pickup trucks with armed men coming his way, but saw none. He hoped that word had been communicated along the route that the cargo truck was to be given safe passage. Nearly 8 hours later, he arrived at his final destination. The dusk was starting to gather, and the wind was picking up. The sky was streaked with clouds, and the rain looked to be a few minutes from bucketing down. When he arrived here, he had expected one precise thing to happen. It didn't. Chapter 2. The first thing to go wrong was his running out of gas as he pulled through the stone building's open overhead door. He had extra fuel tanks, but apparently someone had miscalculated. The second thing to go wrong was the gun being shoved in his face. This was no turban toting a subgun. It was a white man like him with a .357 pistol, its hammer already pulled back. "Is there a problem?" the driver said. "Not for us," said the man, who was heavy-set and jowly, and looked closer to 40 than 30. "Us?" He looked around and saw other white guys creeping out of the shadows. They were all armed, and every gun they had was pointing at him. This many white faces here stuck out like a planet going out of its orbit. "This is not part of the plan," the driver said. The other man held out a cred pack. "There's been a change in plan." The driver studied the ID card and badge. It showed that the man's name was Tim Simons, and identified him as being an agent with the CIA. He said, "If we're on the same side, why the gun in my face?" "In this part of the world, I've learned not to trust anybody. Out! Now!" The driver slung his fully loaded knapsack over his shoulder and stepped down onto the dirt floor holding two things. One was his Glock, which was useless with so many guns centered on him. The second item was the black box. This was entirely useful. In fact, it was the only real bargaining chip he had. He engaged the detonator and pressed down the button. He held it up to Simons. "Failsafe," he said. "Red button gets released. We all get vaporized. Truck is wired all the way around with cakes of Semtex. Enough to make this just a hole in the ground." "Bullshit," countered Simons. "Guess you weren't entirely wired in on the up."
"I think I was."
"Then think again. Look under the wheel wells." Simons nodded at a colleague, who drew a flashlight and ducked under the truck's right rear wheel well. He backed out and turned. His expression said it all. The armed men looked back at the driver. Their superior numbers had just been rendered irrelevant. He knew it, but he also knew this advantage was precarious. A game of chicken could only have, at best, one winner. But it could likely also have two losers. and he was running out of time. He could sense this in the fingers gliding to triggers, in the backward steps the men were trying to make surreptitiously. He could read their minds in every movement. Get out of the Semtex's explosive radius, and either let him detonate and kill himself or take him out with a kill shot and hopefully save the cargo. Either way, they would live, which would be their primary objective. There would be other cargo to hijack, but they could not conjure additional lives. Unless you can run a lot faster than Usain Bolt, you'll never get outside the blast zone in time, he said. He held the box higher. And we'll have an eternity to think about our sins. Simon said, we want what's in the truck. You give us that, you go free. I'm not sure how that would work. Simons nervously eyed the box. There are two pickup trucks parked in the far corner over there. Both are fully fueled with extra cans in the back and each has a GPS. They were our rides getting here, but you take one of them, your choice. The driver eyed the black truck. Next to it was a green pickup. And where exactly do I take it? He asked. I'm assuming out of this shithole. I have a job to do. That job has changed. Why don't we just end this? He started to lessen the pressure on the button. Wait, said Simons. Wait. He held up his hand. I'm waiting. Just take a truck and get out of here. Your cargo is not worth dying for, is it? Maybe it is. You've got a family back in the States. How do you know that? I just do. And I have to believe you want to get back to them. And how do I explain losing the cargo? You won't have to. Trust me, replied Simons. That's the problem. I don't trust you. Then we're all going to die right here. It's that simple. The driver eyed the pickup trucks. He didn't believe anything he had been told. But he desperately wanted to get out of this alive, if only to make things right later. Simon said, look, we're obviously not the Taliban. Hell, I'm from Nebraska. My creds are the real deal. We're on the same side here, okay? Why else would I be here? The driver finally said, so you want me to just withdraw quietly from the field? That was my offer. How do you propose doing this? First thing, don't release the button, advised Simons. Then don't pull your triggers. He edged toward the pickup trucks. The men parted to allow him passage. I'll be taking the green truck, he said abruptly. He saw Simons give a nearly imperceptible flinch, which was good. He'd made the right decision. The black truck was obviously booby-trapped. He reached the green truck and eyed the ignition. The keys were in there. There was also a GPS mounted on the dash. Simons called out, what's the range on the detonator? I'll keep that to myself. He threw his knapsack on the front seat, climbed into the truck and started the engine. He eyed the gas gauge, full. He kept his free hand ready with the detonator. Simons said, how can we trust you not to detonate when you're well away? It's a question of range, he replied. Which you haven't told us. So you just have to trust me, Nebraska, just like I have to trust you that this truck isn't wired to blow up as soon as I'm out of here. Or maybe it was the other one that was. He pushed the gas pedal to the floor and the truck roared out of the stone building. He expected shots to be fired at him. None came. He imagined they believed that would lead to their deaths when he released the button in retaliation. When he was far enough away, he looked at the black box. If the guys back there were CIA, there was a lot more going on here than he cared to think about right now. But he wanted to see it through. And the only way to do that was to let this play out and stay alive. He disengaged the detonator and tossed it on the front seat. Now, he just had to get the hell out of here. He hoped that was possible. Most people came to this part of the world simply to kill or be killed. Chapter 3. Sean King drove while Michelle Maxwell rode shotgun. This was the reverse of what the pair normally did. She usually drove the car, like she was piloting a ride at Daytona. And Sean hung on for dear life and mumbled his prayers, but without much confidence that they would be answered. There was a good reason for his driving tonight and for the last 21 nights. Michelle was simply not herself, at least not yet. She was getting there, only more slowly than she wanted. He looked at her. "How you doing?" She stared straight ahead.
"I am armed, so you ask me that one more time and I will shoot you, Sean."
"I'm just concerned, okay?"
"I know that, Sean, and I appreciate it. But I've been out of rehab for 3 weeks. I think I'm good to go. And that's what your concern can do. Go."
"Your injuries were life-threatening, Michelle. You almost didn't make it. You nearly bled out. Trust me, I was there for every second of it. So 3 weeks out of rehab after something like that is actually not very long." Michelle touched her lower back and then her upper thigh. There were scars there. There would always be scars there. The memory of how she had come by these injuries was as vivid as the initial knife thrust into her back. It had been done by someone she thought was an ally. Yet she was alive, and Sean had been with her every step of the way. Only now, his hovering was starting to annoy her.
"I know, but it was 2 full months of rehab, and I'm a fast healer. You of all people should understand that by now."
"It was just close, Michelle. Way too close."
"How many times have I almost lost you?"
she said, shooting him a glance.
"It's part of what we do. It comes with the territory. If we want safe, we have to get into another line of work."
Sean looked out through the windshield as the rain continued bucketing down. The night was cold, gloomy, the clouds shifty as a coyote. They were driving through a particularly lonely area of Northern Virginia on their way back from meeting with a former client, Edgar Roy. They had saved him from a death sentence. He had been as suitably appreciative as any high-functioning autistic savant with severely limited social skills could be.
"Edgar looked good."
"He looked really good considering the alternative of lethal injection," replied Sean, who seemed relieved by the change in topic. Sean took a turn too fast on the rain-slicked, curvy road, and Michelle grabbed her armrest for support.
"Slow it down."
He feigned astonishment. "Words I never thought I would hear leave your mouth."
"I drive fast because I know how to."
"I've got the injuries and therapy bills to prove otherwise." She gave him a scowl.
"So what now, since we've finished all the work on Edgar Roy's matter?"
"We continue our careers as private investigators. Both Peter Bunting and the U.S. government were very generous with their payments to us, but we're socking that away to either retire on or spend on a rainy day." Michelle looked to the stormy sky.
"Rainy day? Then let's go buy a boat. We might need it to get home."
Sean would have said something back, but he was suddenly preoccupied. "Damn!" He cut the wheel hard to the left and the Land Cruiser spun sideways across a slick roadway.
"Turn into it,"
advised Michelle calmly. Sean turned into the spin and quickly regained control of the vehicle. He applied the brakes and brought them to a stop on the shoulder. "What the hell was that?" he snapped.
"You mean who was that?"
She opened the door and leaned out into the rain. "Michelle, wait," said Sean.
"Point the lights to the right, quick."
She slammed the door shut and Sean drove the vehicle back onto the road.
"Hit your brights."
He did so. The lights swelled in intensity, letting them see farther in front of them with as much clarity as the darkness and rain would allow.
"There,"
said Michelle, pointing to the right.
"Go, go."
Sean hit the gas, and the Land Cruiser sped forward. The person running down the right shoulder of the road looked back only once, but it was enough. "It's a kid," said Sean in amazement.
"It's a teenager."
"Well, he was almost a dead teenager."
"Sean, he's got a gun."
Sean leaned closer to the windshield and saw the weapon in the boy's right hand. "This does not look good," he said.
"He looks terrified."
"He's running in the middle of a thunderstorm with a metal object in his hand. He should be scared. And on top of that, I almost hit him and then he wouldn't be scared, just dead."
"Get closer."
"What?"
"Get closer."
Why would I do that? He's got a gun, Michelle.
We have guns, too. Just get closer.
He sped up while Michelle rolled down the window. A spear of lightning lit the sky with a billion candle power burst of energy, followed by a crack of thunder so loud it sounded like a skyscraper imploding.
Hey!
Michelle yelled at the boy.
Hey!
The teen looked back again, his face whitewashed in the glare of the headlights.
What happened?
Yelled Michelle.
Are you okay?
The boy's answer was to point the gun at them, but he didn't fire. He left the road and cut across a field, his feet slipping and sliding over the wet grass. I'm calling the cops, said Sean.
Just wait. Stop the truck.
Sean slowed the Land Cruiser and pulled to a stop a few feet later. Michelle hopped out of the vehicle. What the hell are you doing? Sean cried out.
He's obviously in trouble. I'm going to find out why.
Did it occur to you that he might be in trouble because he just shot somebody and is running from the scene of the crime?
Don't think so.
He looked at her incredulously. You don't think so? Based on what?
I'll be back.
What? Michelle, wait! He made a grab for her arm, but missed. The next instant, she was sprinting across the field. In a few seconds, she was soaked to the skin in the driving rain. Sean slapped his palm against the steering wheel in disbelief. He yelled out the window, "Do you have a death wish?" But Michelle was long since out of earshot. He calmed, studied the lay of the land for a few moments, and sped off, hanging a right at the next intersection and punching the gas so hard the rear of the truck spun out. He righted it and drove off, cursing his partner loudly with every turn of the wheel. Chapter 4. Michelle had chased many things in her life. As a track star and later Olympic rower, she had constantly pitted herself against others in races. As a cop in Tennessee, she had run down her share of felons fleeing the scenes of their crimes. As a Secret Service agent, she had been fleet of foot next to limos carrying important leaders. Tonight, though, she was competing against the long-legged teenager with the boundless energy and fresh knees of youth, who had a substantial head start and was running as if the devil were on his heels, and her feet kept slipping with every stride over the wet terrain.
Wait!
She called out, as she caught a glimpse of him before he changed direction and disappeared down a path through some trees. He didn't wait. He simply sped up. Michelle, despite her protestations to Sean, was not 100%. Her back hurt, her leg hurt, her lungs were burning, and it didn't help that the wind and rain were blinding her. She raced down the path and just in case drew her gun. She always felt better with her SIG in hand. She redoubled her efforts, fought through the pain and fatigue that were coursing through her, and markedly closed the gap between them. A lightning strike followed by a crack of thunder momentarily distracted her. A tree on the side of the path, punished by stiff winds, started to topple. She found an extra burst of speed and flashed past it. The shallow-rooted tree slammed into the dirt about 10 feet behind her, but its thick branches missed her by only a few inches. Any of them could have crushed her skull. That had been close. The teen had fallen when the tree crashed, yet now he was up and running once more, but the gap between them was narrower. Calling on reserves she wasn't sure she possessed anymore, she propelled herself forward as if she had been shot out of a mortar. She leapt and hit him in the back of the legs. He sprawled forward into the dirt while Michelle pitched sideways and then rose again, her lungs burning, her breath coming in gulps. She bent over but kept her gaze on him, her gun ready, because she could see he still had his, although one glance confirmed that she didn't have to worry about him firing it. He turned over, his butt in the dirt, his knees bent to his chest. Who the hell are you? Why are you chasing me?
Why are you running around with a gun in the middle of a storm?
He looked very young, maybe 15. His auburn hair was plastered to his freckled face. Just leave me alone, he cried out. He rose and Michelle straightened. They were barely 3 feet apart. At 5'10", Michelle was at least 3 inches taller than he was, Although his long legs and size 12 feet promised that he would probably zip right through the 6-foot mark before he was done growing.
What's your name?
He started to back up. Just, please, leave me alone.
I'm trying to help you. My partner and I almost hit you back there.
Your partner? Michelle decided a lie was better than the truth right now.
I'm a cop.
A cop? He looked at her suspiciously. Let me see some ID. She put her hand inside her jacket and withdrew her PI license. In the dark, she hoped it would look legit enough. She flashed it.
Now will you tell me what this is about? Maybe I can help you.
He looked down, his thin chest rising and falling quickly with each of his uneven breaths. Nobody can help me.
That's a big statement to make. Things can't be that bad.
His lips started trembling. Look, I need to get back home.
Is that where you ran away from?
He nodded.
And where you got the gun?
It belonged to my dad. Michelle pulled her wet hair out of her eyes.
We can give you a ride there. Just tell us where it is.
No, I'll walk.
That's not a good idea, not in a storm like this. You might get hit by a car or have a tree fall on you, both of which have already almost happened. What's your name?
He said nothing.
My name is Michelle. Michelle Maxwell.
Are you really a cop?
I used to be one. After that, I was a Secret Service agent.
For real? Now he sounded like a teenager, an odd teenager.
Yep. I'm a private investigator now, but I still act like a cop sometimes. Now, what's your name?
Tyler. Tyler Wingo, he said.
Okay, Tyler Wingo, that's a good start. Now, let's go to my car and...
She glanced behind him, but had no time to say anything. Sean grabbed Tyler from behind, knocked the pistol from his grip, kicked it away, and twirled him around. Staggered, Tyler started to run off again, but Sean clamped a hand around his wrist. At 6'2 and over 200 pounds, he had the size to keep the kid from going anywhere. Let me go, yelled Tyler.
Sean, it's okay,
said Michelle.
Let him go.
Sean reluctantly released his grip, then bent down and picked up the gun. He looked at it. What the hell is this? A German Mauser, said Tyler, scowling up at him.
Without a trigger,
pointed out Michelle.
Saw that in the headlights. Makes it a little hard to use as a weapon unless you throw it at somebody.
Right, said Sean.
Tyler was just going to tell me where he lives, so we can drive him there.
Tyler? Said Sean. Tyler Wingo, said Tyler sulkily. And you better not have damaged my dad's gun. It's a collectible. Sean slipped the gun into his waistband, which made it pretty dumb to run around in the rain with it, he pointed out. Tyler looked at Michelle. Can you just give me a lift home?
Yes, and maybe on the way you can tell us what happened.
I already told you. There's nothing you can do.
You're right. There is absolutely nothing we can do if you don't tell us anything.
Can we go get in the truck? Said Sean. Well, the only place we'll be going is a hospital where they can treat us for pneumonia. Unless the lightning kills us first, he added, as another bolt precipitated a deafening crack of thunder. They got back to the Land Cruiser, where Sean had parked it off the road. There were some blankets in the back cargo area. Michelle grabbed three of these and handed one to Tyler, who draped it around his shoulders. She handed another to Sean and wrapped the last around herself. Thanks, Tyler mumbled. He climbed into the back while Michelle sat next to him. Sean drove. Where to? He asked. Tyler told him. Directions from here? Said Sean. I'm not familiar with this area. Tyler gave him turn-by-turn directions until he hung a left down a street where there were a few older homes located at the end of a cul-de-sac. Which house? Asked Sean. Tyler pointed to one on the right. It was ablaze in light. Michelle and Sean exchanged a glance. Parked in the driveway of the house was a dull green Ford with U.S. Army plates. As they turned into the drive, a woman and two uniformed Army officers came outside on the covered porch.
Why are they here?
She asked Tyler. to tell me my dad was killed in Afghanistan, said Tyler. Chapter 5. The woman rushed toward them in the rain as Sean, Michelle, and Tyler climbed out of the truck. She slipped on one of the cement steps but quickly righted herself and raced across the small patch of soggy lawn. Smoky air rose from her mouth with each breath.
Tyler,
she called out. She was short, about 5'3", and petite, yet she wrapped Tyler in an embrace that threatened to squeeze the life out of him.
Thank God you're all right,
she said.
Thank God.
Both Sean and Michelle observed that Tyler was expressionless during all this. Then he quickly pushed her away. Just stop, he said. You don't have to pretend anymore. He's gone. She stood there, drenched with rain, mascara running down her face. Then she slapped him.
Damn you, Tyler Wingo. You scared me to death.
Michelle stepped in front of her.
Okay, that won't help anything.
Who are you?
Demanded the woman, looking up at Michelle. Sean said, just a couple of people who happened on your son and brought him safely home, that's all. We'll be going now. The soldiers on the porch were dressed in their Class A uniforms and carried dour expressions. One was a case notification officer whose thankless job it was to tell survivors that their family member was dead. The other was a chaplain whose task it was to help the survivors get through this most difficult of times. Michelle put one arm on Tyler's shoulder.
You okay?
He dumbly nodded, his gaze on the two men on the porch. He looked as though they were aliens here to snatch him. Michelle took a card from her jacket and handed it to him.
You need anything, give us a call, okay?
Tyler said nothing but slipped the card into his jeans and headed to the porch. The woman said,
I didn't mean to slap him. I was just so worried. Thank you for bringing him back.
Sean held out his hand. I'm Sean King. This is Michelle Maxwell. We're very sorry for your loss. Things like this are never easy, especially on the kids.
It's not easy on any of us,
said the woman.
I'm Jean Wingo, by the way. Tyler is my stepson.
Sean started to pull out the German Mauser, but Michelle froze him with a glance. She said,
Again, we're really sorry, Mrs. Wingo. Tyler seems like a good kid. Anything we can do to help, just let us know.
Thank you, but the Army will be there for us. They have a family care program the soldiers were telling us about. They'll be in touch tomorrow.
That's good, said Sean. I'm sure they'll be a big comfort to you now.
How long had Tyler been gone?
Michelle asked. Jean said,
He ran out of here about 2 hours ago. I had no idea where he'd gone. I was so worried.
I see,
said Michelle with a frown, as she glanced up at Tyler, who was standing on the porch looking down at them. The two soldiers were trying to speak to him, but it was clear he wasn't listening to them. Again, we're very sorry, said Sean. He turned to Michelle. You ready to go? I'm sure the Army and the Wingos have a lot to go over. Michelle nodded, but her gaze stayed on Tyler. She held up one of her business cards as a reminder to him. Then she and Sean climbed into the Land Cruiser and drove off. Michelle watched in the rearview mirror as the Wingos and the soldiers slowly walked back inside the house. As Sean sped up, Michelle eased gingerly back into the seat. He noted her discomfort. Little sore? You only have yourself to blame, chasing a kid in a thunderstorm. You probably pulled every muscle you have. I know my knees are killing me, and I didn't run half as far or hard as you did.
KIA,
said Michelle. Killed in action, right, replied Sean. It sucks. One U.S. soldier dead is one too many in my book.
Tyler and his stepmom don't seem to get along.
Just because she slapped him, he'd run off. And like she said, she was worried sick. She overreacted. They're going through the worst stress a family will ever have to endure, Michelle. You have to cut her some slack.
Right. She was worried sick. Yet Tyler was gone for 2 hours, and she wasn't even wet until she came down to slap him. If it were my kid, I would have run down the street after him. It's not like he took a car. He was on foot. She couldn't go after him? What, was she afraid of a little rain?
Sean started to say something, but then stopped. He finally said, I don't know. The soldiers weren't wet either. Well, maybe it's not their job to go chasing after a kid. We weren't there. We don't know how it went down. Maybe she went after him in the car.
She still would have been wet. They didn't have a garage, not even a carport. And remember what Tyler said? After he pushed her away, he said she could stop pretending now that his dad was gone. Stop pretending what? That she cared about Tyler's dad?
Maybe, maybe not. But it's none of our business.
And why would Tyler take his dad's collectible gun of all things?
What part of none of our business did you fail to grasp?
I don't like things that don't make sense.
Look, we don't know anything about him. Maybe the gun meant something to Tyler. Maybe the kid was so crushed finding out his dad was dead that he just grabbed the first thing he saw of his and took off. And why are we even talking about this? He's back home where he belongs. Sean glanced down at his waistband. Crap, I've still got the gun. I was going to give it back until you gave me the evil eye. And why exactly did you do that?
Because it gives us an excuse to go back there, preferably tomorrow.
Go back? Why? He exclaimed.
I want to find out more.
We found the kid and brought him home. Our work is done.
You're not the least bit curious?
No, why would I be?
I saw how he looked at his stepmom. I heard what he said. There was no love there.
That's life. All families are dysfunctional. It's only a question of degrees. But it doesn't make me want to jump into the middle of the traumatic situation they're going through. Right now, they need family and friends to support them.
We could be Tyler's friend.
Look, why the hell are you doing this?
Doing what?
Inserting yourself in the lives of people we don't even know.
Don't we do that all the time as part of our work?
Yes, our work. Not something like this. It's not a case, so don't treat it like one. No one has hired us, Michelle, so we move on.
I feel like I know Tyler, or at least what he's going through.
How can you? Your dad is still alive. Sean broke off. Michelle's father was still alive, but her mother wasn't. She'd been murdered. And Michelle had initially suspected her father of committing the crime. And that had eventually led to her coming to grips with the memory from childhood that had eaten at her like a cancer throughout her adult life. A psychologist friend of Sean's had subsequently gotten through to her and had done some investigation into her past. With his help, coupled with some traumatic moments at the home where she'd grown up, Michelle had finally righted herself. But none of it had been easy, and he never wanted her to go through something like that again. The knife wounds had healed. The emotional scars she had suffered would remain just that. The weight of each one was immense. He didn't know how many she could carry around before being crushed. Sean tapped on the steering wheel to the beat of the rain on the truck's roof. He glanced at Michelle. She was staring off, seemingly lost. And a part of him felt like he was losing her again, when he had just gotten her back. We can at least return the gun, said Sean quietly. He wiped wet hair out of his face. Let's do it tomorrow. Hopefully when it's not raining.
Thanks,
said Michelle, without looking at him. They drove to Michelle's apartment where Sean had left his car, a Lexus convertible hardtop. In the covered garage, they climbed out of the truck. Sean passed the keys over to her. You gonna be okay tonight? He asked.
A soak in the tub and I'll be fine. You should ice your knees.
Sucks getting old.
You're not old.
But I'm getting close. He fiddled with his own keys. Even though it's cold, you should go sculling tomorrow on the Potomac. That always makes you feel better.
Sean, stop worrying. I'm not going nuts again.
You never went nuts, he said emphatically.
But I got close,
she replied, paraphrasing his earlier statement. You want some company tonight? He asked, giving her a sideways glance.
Not tonight. But thanks for the offer.
I'm sure this Tyler Wingo thing is nothing.
You're probably right.
But we'll take the gun back and see what we see.
Thanks for humoring me.
I'm not humoring you. I'm being diplomatic.
Then thanks for being diplomatic.
She walked toward the elevator that would take her up into the building. Sean watched her until she was safely inside the elevator car. He needn't have bothered. He had watched her take out five guys at the same time without breaking much of a sweat. Still, he watched her. Still, he worried about her. He guessed that's what being a partner was all about. He walked to his car, climbed in, and drove off at a slow, safe speed. Chapter 6. Sam Wingo stared down at the map. First, he'd lost his cargo and nearly his life. Second, the pickup truck he'd taken had run out of fuel halfway across Afghanistan, not where one would want to come up empty on petrol. His options from that point had been limited. To the north were three of the Stan countries, to the west was Iran, and to the east and south was Pakistan. Not a clear winner among them as an escape route. Being an American in one of the stands was probably preferable to being an American in Iran or even Pakistan. But Wingo knew where he eventually wanted to get to. India. Yet going through one of the stands and hooking around to India through China was not going to cut it for him. It was just too far. After he'd run out of fuel, he had waylaid a man with his spare camel. He'd paid him far more in local currency than he had probably ever seen. Then Wingo had ridden the beast over some of the roughest terrain in the country, with the sun beating down on him, turning any bit of exposed skin red and dry. He arrived on the outskirts of Kabul in the morning hours. He finally had cell reception. He had turned off his phone on the trip to conserve his battery. The camel did not come equipped with a 110-volt outlet. He phoned his superior, Colonel Leon South.
"What in the hell happened out there?" said South.
"I was hoping you could tell me," said Wingo.
"Where are you?"
"I got ambushed out there, a dozen to one."
"Where are you, Sam?"
It was bothering Wingo that the man had asked the same question twice. Wingo said, "Where are you?"
"This is beyond a disaster," snapped South.
"There was nothing I could do. Like I said, it was a dozen to one, and the leader had a cred pack that said CIA. It looked real enough, but I still didn't buy their story."
"Bullshit."
"Tim Simons. He said he was from Nebraska. Check it out."
"I'm not checking out anything until you come in."
"There was nothing I could do, sir."
"You had a failsafe, Wingo. But since you're talking to me, I guess you didn't deploy it when you were under strict orders to do just that if things went wrong. If you had doubts about who they were, why are you still alive?"
"The cred pack said CIA. Even if I was skeptical, I didn't want to risk blowing up our own guys."
"I don't give a shit if the cred pack said Jesus Christ. Do you realize what you've done?"
"Yeah, it had occurred to me."
"Where is the truck?"
"I don't know."
"And the cargo?"
"With the truck, last time I checked."
"This is not good, Wingo. Not good at all."
"Yeah, that had occurred to me too."
"If you did something with the cargo," began South.
Wingo cut him off. "If I had stolen it, do you think I'd be wasting time calling you?"
"If you wanted to cover your ass, you would."
"With that cargo, why would I need to do that?"
"Couldn't tell you. I don't think like a criminal or a traitor."
"Of which I'm neither."
"That's good to hear. No fallout then. But you really need to come in."
"Not until I know more."
"We recruited you especially for this mission. We laid all the groundwork, spent God knows how much time and money, took more risks than we ever should have, and now it's all gone to hell, and you're right in the middle of it. I knew we never should have just sent out one guy. Temptation was too great."
"I was never tempted."
"Yeah. Some guys just strolled along in the middle of freaking Afghanistan, and in the mother of all coincidences, took it from you." I was supposed to be met by freedom fighters, not the CIA. They were not the CIA, yelled South. You know that for sure? Wingo snapped. He could hear South breathing heavily, but the colonel did not answer him. They were there. They knew what was in the truck. Their cred pack looked legit. This guy Simons said the plan had changed. The plan had not changed. I would have known if it had. I am not making this shit up, sir. It happened. South didn't say anything for a few moments. Okay. Give me a description of this guy and anybody else with him. Wingo did so. It was easy enough. He had been trained to remember details like that, and the truth was, when someone shoved a gun in your face, you did remember what he looked like, because it might be the last face you ever saw. I'll see what I can find out, Wingo. But your staying out there has already confirmed your guilt to a lot of folks here that matter. What happened to the people I was supposed to meet? They were at the rendezvous spot. No, they weren't. Let me be more specific. They were found in shallow graves behind the building that was the rendezvous spot. Wingo drew a quick breath. Then the CIA must have killed them.
Well, maybe you did.
Sir.
Did you kill them?
South roared. No, snapped Wingo. If those guys weren't CIA and the plan hasn't changed, then they were wired into the whole thing. Which means we have a damn leak somewhere.
Look, Wingo, your partner is done. You need to come in, give your debriefing, and we'll go from there.
I need to make this right, said Wingo.
What you need to do is come in, soldier.
Why? So you can stick me in some prison somewhere? Sounds like you're pretty well convinced of my guilt.
It doesn't really matter if you're guilty or not. You royally screwed up your mission and disobeyed direct orders. Any way you cut it, you're ending up in the stockade for a long time.
At these words, Wingo rested his head against the stone wall of the old building he was standing next to. His heart sank right down to the Afghan dirt. Military prison for the rest of my life?
I need you to contact my son and tell him I'm all right, said Wingo. I don't want him to worry.
Wingo heard South clear his throat.
That's not possible, said South.
Why not? He was told I was MIA. Just tell him I've been found. I don't want him to worry about me.
He doesn't think you're MIA.
South paused.
He was told you were KIA.
Wingo didn't say anything for 5 beats. What the hell are you talking about? He said in a deadly whisper.
The chances were very high you would not come back alive, Wingo.
I'm not dead yet.
It's done. It can't be undone without doing huge damage to the mission. Even more damage, he added.
I can't believe this. My son thinks I'm dead? What idiot authorized that? Wingo barked.
You have no one to blame but yourself. We thought you were dead. You didn't report in.
I couldn't report in. I had no way to report in until just now.
Well, you have a lot more to worry about than that, soldier, South said. Are you still in country? I can send a chopper or a Humvee, depending on where you are.
I'm not in country, lied Wingo, his head still spinning. South spoke slowly and with great deliberation.
Tell me exactly where you are, and I will send people to pick you up.
I don't think so, sir.
Wingo!
Next time I call, I would appreciate some real answers instead of bullshit. And if anything happens to my son, anything, because of this, I will hold you, personally, responsible.
Wingo!
But Wingo had already clicked off. And then he turned off his phone. He'd already disabled the GPS chip in it. He knew that South had been stationed in Kabul, so the good colonel was probably within 15 minutes by car from him. But Wingo was not hanging around Kabul or Afghanistan. He started walking. It was clear from what South had said and what he had left unspoken that Wingo was being set up as the fall guy on this. But what felt like a dozen AR-15 rounds penetrating his body was the thought of Tyler believing his dad was dead. He tightened his knapsack strap and picked up his pace. Inside the knapsack was everything he had. But South knew about the IDs he'd been given, which meant he couldn't use them, or the next thing he'd be facing was a court-martial. He had to get out of Afghanistan, through Pakistan, and into India. He could lose himself in New Delhi or Mumbai, and then figure out a new course of action. It would also give him time to change his appearance and construct a new ID, because he wasn't planning on staying in India. His ultimate destination was home. He was going to make this right somehow. He looked down at his phone and turned it on. Should he call his son? He hesitated, trying to think through what such an action might do. Finally, he compromised with himself. He thumbed in a carefully worded email and hit send. Then he hurried off. Thousands of miles away, Tyler Wingo's phone buzzed, and a hand reached for the phone. And nothing would ever be the same again. Chapter 7. The oars cut cleanly through the murky water. The rains had passed and the sky was cloudless. The winds that had beaten off the storm system had come up from the warmer southwest, but it was still cold enough to see your breath. Michelle worked the oars with a polished motion, built up over many years of piloting narrow vessels with barely a foot-deep draft through water. She didn't have to think about what she was doing. She just had to pull and recoil, moving in a precise straight line because getting off course cost precious seconds. Every muscle in her body was engaged at some point, particularly the core and the lower body, where a person's real strength was housed. She would take oblique mass and corded thighs over tank-top beach muscle. The Potomac was empty of boats except for a police vessel that was slowly chugging its way south toward Memorial Bridge. Michelle was heading the other way, following a route to the old boathouses that hugged the shore near Georgetown. Perched on the hood of his Lexus, Sean watched his partner methodically make her way back to her starting point. He was glad to see that she had taken his advice and put her shell in the water, even if it was cold outside. She was at peace there, he knew, one of the few places she was likely to find it. He only took his gaze off her once, when a massive gull started swirling in the air, pivoting, dropping, and then swooping upward. That was real freedom, thought Sean. Must be nice. He settled his gaze back on his partner. They had been intimate on one occasion, and never again after that. He had thought about the reasons behind this. They were many and varied. The sex had been great. The morning after had been confused, as though they had both been culpable in stepping over a sacred boundary and had nearly ruined a perfectly good partnership by doing so. She pulled up at the ramp to one of the boathouses painted yellow and green. Sean pushed himself off the Lexus hood and came forward to help her. She wore a dark blue one-piece wetsuit with booties that allowed free range of motion and protected her against the chill. It revealed not an ounce of fat on her tall body, but it also showcased how thin she was. Together, they tied the shell to the top of her Land Cruiser, and Michelle angled her oars through the truck's back window. They were long enough to reach into the front seats. Sean gazed inside her car. It was full of trash, most of which should have been tossed a long time ago. She noted him staring and said,
"Don't go there. I'll clean it out at some point."
"Right. When you can no longer reach the steering wheel?"
"That's very funny, Sean. And you always claim not to be a morning person."
Sean snagged two coffees from his car and handed her one. She took a sip. "You look good out there," he said.
"BS I can do without."
"What do you mean?" She stretched out her shoulder until she was rewarded with a pop.
"I'm slower than I've ever been. I couldn't make a high school team right now."
"We all get old."
"Not all of us. Not Tyler's dad."
Sean drank his coffee and looked off toward the water. "We're officially pulling out of Afghanistan, but we still have casualties. Dying for what?"
"You could ask that question in just about every war."
I didn't see the trigger was missing from the Mauser, he admitted, glancing at her.
I probably had a better angle than you did. He was on my side of the road. If we'd been in England, you would have spotted it instead of me.
You still lie really well.
Comes in handy in our line of work.
I know I said we needed to get back on casework, but maybe I was wrong. Maybe instead we should take some of the money and go somewhere. Michelle stared at him quizzically. She leaned against the hood of her truck and said,
Why the sudden change in plan?
I'm a spontaneous person.
Your idea of spontaneity is going with 89 octane over full premium.
You never really got any downtime, Michelle. It was hospital, surgeries, rehab. That was hard work. You need a break. We both need a break.
And our rainy day fund?
Frankly, we've got enough money to get away for a while and have plenty left over. I vote for someplace warm and sandy where they line the drinks up for you all loaded with limes and salt. You can see me in my swimsuit, and you can wear a bikini.
Why? To better show off my scars?
Sean's face fell. You know I didn't mean it like that. Her features softened.
I know.
Besides, I've got some of my own. And you've seen them all, he added, smiling.
One of them is actually sort of cute.
So will you at least think about us getting away for a little R&R?
That actually might be nice.
And Tyler Wingo?
I guess I was trying to insert myself where I don't belong. Maybe we can just mail him back the gun.
Now you're talking. I can check into travel arrangements and we can nail this whole thing down in a couple of days. You ever been to New Zealand?
No.
I went there on a trip when I was guarding the VP. Let me tell you, the word paradise does not cut it. And it's their summer season now. Her phone buzzed. She looked at the screen.
Just hold that thought. Hello? Yes, this is Michelle Maxwell.
She listened and then said,
Okay, I understand.
She was silent for about a minute as she listened some more, then said,
We can make that. Give me the address.
She saw Sean giving her the high sign not to commit, but ignored it. She clicked off and slipped the phone back into her waterproof fanny pack. Who was that? Asked Sean.
Tyler Wingo.
Does he want his gun that bad?
No, he didn't mention the gun.
What then?
He wants to hire us.
Sean gaped at her. Hire us? For what?
To find out what happened to his dad.
We know what happened to his dad. He was killed in action while serving in the army in Afghanistan. And we are not going to Afghanistan to confirm his death if that's what he's asking us to do. The military can do that perfectly fine without our help. And you just said yourself that you are inserting yourself where you didn't belong. We were going to jump on a plane to New Zealand.
But that was before he called. Tyler wants to meet.
Sean let out a long sigh. Meet where, at his house?
No, he wants to keep this between him and us for now. He didn't mention anyone specifically, but it was easy to see that he doesn't want his stepmother to know.
First of all, he's a minor, and he can't hire us because he can't legally enter into a service agreement with us. It would be unenforceable by us. She gave him a disappointed look.
That's just legal mumbo-jumbo. You're not an attorney anymore.
Once an attorney, always an attorney. And it's not just mumbo-jumbo. It's how we get paid.
I'm sure he'll pay us.
Well, I'm glad you're confident. But I'm also not going to take money from a grieving teenager when there is no investigative work for us to do. His dad is KIA. It's a moot point. The Pentagon is really good at identifying remains. The soldiers carry dog tags and they keep DNA samples now and everything. If they say he's dead, then he's dead.
I don't know if Tyler is disputing that his father is dead. He has another reason he wants to hire us.
What?
He wants to know how he died.
Didn't the Army tell him and his stepmom? That's part of what they do when they notify next of kin.
Apparently, Tyler was not satisfied with their explanation.
This is crazy, Michelle. The kid is obviously not thinking clearly.
It might be crazy, but there's something to be said for helping grieving teenagers get through a really bad situation.
And you think we can do that?
We've done it lots of times before for lots of different people, some even younger than Tyler.
That's true. So if not at his home, where does he want to meet?
At his high school.
His high school? He just found out his dad